Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Hey, Lulu here. Whether we are romping through science, music, politics, technology, or feelings, we seek to leave you seeing the world anew. Radiolab adventures right on the edge of what we think we know, wherever you get podcasts.
Welcome back to All of It on WNYC. I'm Nancy Giles, filling in for Allison Stewart. It's common knowledge that manufacturing is on the decline in the U.S., but it's less common to get a detailed account of what that really means for those who used to work on factory floors. A new film directed and produced by Stephen Bognar, did I say that right?
Bognar,
mm-hmm. and Julia Reichert takes us deep inside a former GM plant in Dayton, Ohio, that was brought back to life by a Chinese glass manufacturer. The filmmakers gained intimate access not only to the factory floor, but also to those at the very top of this massive multinational organization, creating a thorough picture of what it means to work in a factory in the U.S. in the age of globalization, and what challenges exist to creating protections for workers' rights in this environment. Mm-hmm. The film is called American Factory, and it comes out today on Netflix, as well as at IFC. And tonight, Julia Reichert will be at IFC for a Q&A mm-hmm. after the 6:30 screening.
I'm looking forward to that.
I bet. Julia Reichert joins all of us back in May to discuss her retrospective at MoMA. Very impressive. And I'm so pleased to welcome her back to the show now. Welcome.
Thank you so much. Thank you.
So tell me, how did you first learn about the takeover of this GM plant by the glass manufacturing company? What is it? Fuyao?
It's called Fuyao Glass America.
Fuyao Glass America.
Also referred to as FGA, which I might use. By the way, my impression is not that actually manufacturing is on the decline. It might actually be on the rise. Oh. There are probably still, I mean, I think there's a decline in the fate of workers in manufacturing.
Well put.
Not necessarily in the numbers. There's probably at least 10 million Americans who work in manufacturing. And then, of course, there are all kinds of other jobs where you don't, you know, work in large places, call centers, distribution centers. So those are, there's a lot of people who work in those kinds of jobs.
True.
Where they have very little agency over what they do, where their pay has been depressed, where the sense that they can have a life of support and security is really not available to them. And it used to be, of course, manufacturing jobs used to be basically pretty good jobs. You know, you could raise a family, you would have benefits.
Right.
My dad was a union man, a working class guy, and, you know, we had vacations.
Insurance.
Yeah, health insurance. Mm-hmm. We had summer vacations. We had a summer house. It was a trailer, but, you know,
yeah.
All those kind of good, secure things that a working class, blue collar, middle class family would have. And that's changed a lot. So, but back to your question, how did we,
you first asked- learn about this takeover and learn about the new company that took over the GM plant? How'd you learn about it?
Yeah, well, they came to our town. I mean, of course, we made a film about the closing of that plant, the General Motors plant, called The Last Truck. It
right.
was an HBO film.
2009. Yeah.
Yeah, we shot in 2008 when the economy was collapsing and came out in 2009 on Labor Day. So in our town, you know, that plant stood empty. It was huge, bigger than the Pentagon, actually. And it stood empty for almost 8 years. And then we got the news in the paper, just like everybody else, that the plant was bought and there would be manufacturing again in Dayton. Jobs were coming. And it turned out that the owner was, and the founder of the company was Chairman Chow, is a Chinese entrepreneur, mm-hmm. billionaire. And I will say, he started the company from scratch. He took a chance on Dayton. He did bring jobs to Dayton. The question was always going to be, you know, what kind of jobs are they going to be?
Exactly.
What kind of and so we didn't, who knows? And so we realized this could be a really significant film. We ended up getting amazing access.
Can we talk about that?
Sure.
The access was crazy. How did you get in there? I mean, you spoke to everyone from all sides. It was almost as if people behaved as if the cameras weren't there. How did you do that?
Well, first of all, the access. I have to give credit to the chairman. People in our town who helped attract the business to Dayton, Ohio, where I live, where Steve and I live, said, you know, look, these two people made a very sad story about the closing of this giant manufacturing plant that had sustained our diverse middle class for years and years, decades, generations.
I mean, that plant was the livelihood of that town for the longest kind of time.
It was. Yeah. It was. And it helped create a diverse middle class. It actually helped create funk music, by the way, because people had money to buy guitars and they had garages because they had homes.
Hello, manufacturing and art. It's all of a piece.
It is. And we had good public schools that had music programs. We forget that. That if we don't have good public schools, we don't have music programs, we don't get stuff like funk.
You're right. I even like just hearing you say funk. Anyway, continue.
Yeah. So anyway, they approached the chairman and asked if, you know, he would be interested in having a film, a documentary film made about the plant. We had three conditions. One is we would take no money whatsoever from the plant. I think they had in mind to hire us to make the film, but of course, as independent filmmakers, we don't do that.
Right.
Two is that we would have editing control, like we would have complete control over the editing. We would, of course, you know, show it to them, but we would have, before it was done, which we did, but have no control over the editing. We would listen to them. And third, that we would have access, that we would have access to management, to the engineers, to the blue-collar Americans, to the blue-collar Chinese. And to his credit, he said yes.
The chairman said yes.
The chairman said yes. And, you know, in China, if the chairman says yes, the answer is yes, whether people like it or not. And so we were there for 3 years almost. Things changed a lot. We didn't know what to expect. I mean, going in there at the beginning, we just went in, tried to see what it was like, tried to create relationships.
How did you do that? How did you build up trust with the different groups there?
Yeah. Well, first of all, say you saw the film. It's very beautiful because it's glass.
It
and
is,
everybody is beautifully lit.
There, the shots are so cinematic. You
it
know,
is, it's
you forget every once in a while that you are in a plant in a glass
a
manufacturing factory.
So that was one thing. So we did a lot of filming of people working, passing glass back and forth. Another thing, though, is we had to be aware that, you know, we have a very like upstairs downstairs very multi-leveled story with people from very different points of view.
True.
Right? The stakes for the workers are different than the stakes for the managers, and the stakes for the owner is different again.
Mm-hmm.
And even the stakes for the Chinese and the Americans were different. So we had to make really sure that we honored everybody, that we remained neutral. I'll give you an example because you're a journalist also.
Well, I'm more of an opinion person. I have to like lay that out.
Okay.
So, because I give all due respect and credit to journalists, but please continue.
Okay.
Your point.
Well, so this is a kind of filmmaker story, real quick. But you know, you're carrying around a tripod, a heavy camera, a backpack with all your stuff in it, and you're walking miles every day, concrete floors, and sometimes a go-kart would go by, one of those electric carts with a management person on it who would say, hey, you guys, you want to ride? And we'd be like, oh my gosh, thank you so much. And then we'd whiz past the blue collar workers who would see us riding with management and would be like,
uh-oh.
Oh, you're with management. And so we realized we could not take those rides.
Oh.
So there were many, many times we...
a smart move.
Yeah,
as
we realized we
were.
Had to do that. Yeah, and if management saw us working, saw us talking to people with a union t-shirt on, they would immediately assume you must be pro-union, and they wouldn't like that. So we had to say, you know, we're neutral on that. It's part of the story.
Right.
The union struggle, which you saw, is part of the story. So we had to cover that.
I'm speaking with Julia Reichert about her new film, American Factory, that comes out today on Netflix and is premiering tonight at IFC. And she'll be speaking at IFC tonight for a Q&A at the 6:30 screening.
Mm-hmm.
In the film, you travel to China and you look at how the union that represents Fuyao's, how do you say it? Fuyao's workers, how that union functions. Can you talk a little bit about how that union functions in, as opposed to the UAW and how that works here in the United States?
Well, I can say I'm not an expert on Chinese unions, but I do know that all workers in China are in the same union.
Okay.
It's part of the government, which is the Communist Party. So the Union and the Communist Party are very tightly aligned.
That sort of, it almost sounds counterintuitive to Union.
Yeah, and the working and the owners are also very beholden to the government. So, you know, my understanding is that while there's not like a right to strike, there's not a lot of safety. There's some safety concerns.
Really?
But yeah, but I mean, it's like here in a way. I don't want to make China sound like it is very different over there. But, you know, there are laws about safety there. There are laws about safety here. Do all companies on the factory floor completely abide by all the safety rules, all the OSHA, all the EPA? No, they don't.
That goes for both countries.
It goes for both. It goes for global countries. You know, the drive for profit, which we saw, the drive for profit creates a lot of pressure on workers, creates pressure to work overtime, to work faster, to work through your breaks sometimes. And that is happening around the world. And I hope people kind of get that from our film. It's not a partisan film. It doesn't have a specific message. It's more of a cinema verite documentary. But I do hope that you can see that the fate of workers around the country is stagnant. I mean, wages are stagnant. Conditions are not improving really that much, or if at all. And workers sort of, the people who do the work, who make stuff around the world, have a lot in common. They have more in common than they do with the billionaires who own their companies.
This and is if, across if, the board.
It
all
is across the board.
All workers have that in common, you feel like?
I do. And I feel like if, as a country, we don't address the income disparities that are becoming greater and greater, and the sort of potential of workers to feel like they have a pathway to the middle class,
mm-hmm.
right? Those are closing down and closing down. This is not stable for our country. It's not really stable for our world. Not that the film directly talks about this. There's no narration in the film.
Yes, which I have a slight little bone to pick with you because,
okay.
among other things, I do. I have narrated documentaries.
Yeah, and, me too,
in a
actually.
Way. And of course, when I saw that, I was like, I'm going to have to talk to Julia about that. But I find it to be really effective in this in this piece, that the moments where you don't hear anything, where you just sit and observe and it's silent.
You just watch.
Yeah. Did you know going in you didn't want to use a narrator, or is this something that came to you as you were filming?
It more came to us as we were editing. I wouldn't be opposed to a narrator, but it didn't feel like this film needed it. We captured so much of just the real daily lives of people, whether they're Chinese or American, management, owner. We captured so much of their lives in globalization. I mean, globalization is a big word, right? It's kind of a scary word. What does it really mean? I think in our film, you see that in the daily lives of people, of just regular people in Dayton, Ohio, but it's kind of universal too. So no narrators, there's no graphs, there's no charts, it's really a cinema verite.
It is.
Immersive. You know, I don't know if you remember the great filmmaker, D.A. Pennybaker.
Of course.
Who we just lost just like a week or two ago. And Penny was a mentor to many of us. And one of the things he always said was, just immerse. Just go immerse and see where your interest is and find the story. We didn't go in knowing what the story was going to be.
It doesn't feel like you did. It really does feel like it emerged as
in
we
front
watched.
Of us,
yes.
It immersed in front, and we were chasing it like a runaway train. I mean, it became our lives. Every morning, waking up, who should we be talking to? Where should we be? What did we miss? It was very amazing, and we followed a lot of people. We had 5 cinematographers. So it was wonderful. I have to say, going to China, meeting all these workers, both U.S. and Chinese, was just so enriching to our lives and our understanding of what's going on in the globe today. It's like tectonic plates are shifting. We all feel that. But what does it look like on a human level?
That's
how, what a film can offer.
That's true. And I think I felt like watching your film, I understood globalization better than I ever had by seeing these personal stories.
Mm-hmm.
Your film won the Best Directing Award for Documentary at Sundance this year. Congratulations.
Mm-hmm.
Can you explain how the Obamas came to acquire your completed film and why you think they chose it as the first film that they would release as part of their Netflix partnership?
Yes, I hope I can explain it. We heard about their company, which is called Higher Ground.
Higher Ground, right.
Which I love that name.
Isn't
I love
great?
That they chose that name. When we were at Sundance, you know, what happens with brand new documentaries like that is if you have a good film, you get pitched by a lot of companies who want to buy it, who want to acquire it
right.
and put it out into the world.
There's more appetite for documentaries, it feels like, of late. Is that right?
Yes,
yeah.
Absolutely.
Wonderful.
More people go to theaters. There are some such excellent documentaries this year. I mean, last year we had RBG. I saw it three times. You know, people brought their daughters and their friends and Won't You Be My Neighbor. There were so many great wonderful films.
Wonderful ones.
And there's more this year.
Right.
So at Sundance, we had a pitch meeting with Netflix. And it was huge. There were probably 20 people who walked into the room. They gave us a really big, really solid pitch. And of the people there, there were two people who identified themselves as being with Higher Ground.
Okay.
What is that? So our mouths hit the floor when they said Higher Ground is the production company of the president and first lady. And we thought we didn't hear right. But then they started referring to them as POTUS and FLOTUS. So we realized that's who they were talking about. So that's how we found out that they had chosen our film. They had probably seen lots of films and decided to choose ours. Their company, from what I now understand, is really interested in elevating storytellers, artists, writers, you know, filmmakers, people who work on television. If you think, it makes sense to me because if you think about it, both of them have written excellent books.
Right.
They're both storytellers. I think they understand what we as documentary filmmakers do. If you think about the First Lady's book, I was just finishing it, and one of the things she says at the end on the last page, she says, wherever she goes, when she walks in whatever room, and you can imagine all the rooms she's walked into, everything from, you know, the most poor to the most, you know,
to
gala.
The queen, yeah.
Yeah,
sure.
Exactly. She said, I just try to be myself and connect. And that's what we try to do, is connect, is immerse. So we have met them, and there's now online, there's a video that we made with them. It just came out today.
That's so exciting.
Yeah. So they were lovely. They're very engaging. They were very easy to be with. And I think they liked our film because it takes the higher ground.
Mm-hmm.
It tries to be fair to everybody. It tries to listen to all those different voices and treat them honorably and fairly. And I think with the divisive world we live in, we need more higher ground. We need more to find common ground. And the president said it in this little video that we made. The way you find common ground is to learn somebody else's story.
That's great. We're going to take a break and we're going to come back and talk to you a little bit more with Julia Reichert after the break. Welcome back to All of It. I'm Nancy Giles. I'm subbing for Allison Stewart and in a conversation right now with Julia Reichert about her new film, American Factory, which comes out today on Netflix, new documentary, as well as IFC, as well as at IFC. And tonight, Julia will be at IFC for a Q&A at the 6:30 screening. It's an amazing film. There's a shocking moment in the film, shocking to me. We hear this manager at the factory talking about how he's managing workers who are trying to organize, right?
Mm-hmm.
And he's speaking in Mandarin, and the subtitles say that he's basically trying to fire people for trying to organize. And now this moment in the film made headlines. This is the Dayton Daily News, and this is a report as of 5:30 yesterday. They said Jeff Liu, chief executive of Fuyao Glass America, said Monday a subtitle translation in the Netflix documentary American Factory, a translation in which Liu appears to tell Fuyao's chairman that he has fired supporters of a unionization effort at the company. He says it's misleading. The paper also says that you stand by your translation and that firing workers for supporting or assisting a unionization effort is considered a civil violation of the National Labor Relations Act. Now, I want to talk about that from a couple of different angles, but can you explain just on a basic level, what is your process for translating the Mandarin dialogue? Because that's really important, because
definitely
one does not want anything to be lost in translation, literally.
No. We were very careful. We had three different translators.
Okay.
The entire film was translated by three different, born and raised in China, bilingual people.
Okay.
And in some cases where they might have differed, because Chinese is a very subtle and nuanced language. And there might be times when somebody would come out with a slightly different word. So then we would always go to yet another person, a fourth person, to make sure that everyone would agree that we came out with the best word. So when President Liu says that, I mean, he's incorrect. We actually, after we read that yesterday,
right,
we went back and asked yet another translator, and he said the word, it could be interpreted as either eliminated or fired.
There's not a lot.
Which there's really, what's
Come
the
on.
Difference? You know, yeah.
Okay.
So everybody feels like that. I mean, there's no question that, well, not only that, it isn't like we had a gotcha scene where that's the only time in the film you see that. There's another situation, well, you've seen the film. There's another situation where a worker holds up a photograph of a supervisor holds up a worker of a picture and says, see this guy? He's not going to be here in 2 weeks. And there were other situations where one of the characters in our film was fired, and she firmly believes that it was for, she didn't start out as a union supporter, but when she saw the way things went, she decided to throw in and join the union campaign. She was fired. It was very common that people who wore those union t-shirts or who were activists or who talked to people at lunch, you know, and said, hey, do you want to sign a card? Those people would disappear.
And just for having a conversation.
Yeah, or yes, and for being pro-union. And that it isn't as though that only happens. In fact, it's not a Chinese thing. There were labor relations consultants who were brought in and paid a lot of money to fight the union,
right,
to avoid the union. And they were very effective.
They were effective.
They actually were very effective. So they created a kind of a tense atmosphere, and I think they confused people a lot. They intimidated people, but they can do that. That's legal. They walk right up to the legal line. But the firing of workers for being pro-union is definitely
illegal. Yeah.
And also, it's undemocratic. I mean, it's not fair. Don't we believe in democratic elections in this country? I think we do. And I think when you get rid of people who support a certain side. Now, of course, some of these folks, a few of them, filed what's called unfair labor practices. By the way, we learned about all this doing the film.
Right.
And the company settled with them. So, and some of them got some back pay. Some of them didn't. But so that happened. We would never have a gotcha moment. That's not the kind of filmmakers
it wasn't
we
that
are.
Kind of
and
film.
It was not poorly translated.
Right.
And what we saw really, the film is partly about like workers' rights. Workers' rights, which we forget, you have rights at work. We have the National Labor Relations Act. It may be weak, it may be not well enforced. It should be better enforced. We should ask all our candidates, you know, what are you doing about labor law?
Exactly.
What are you doing about strengthening law for working people? But we have rights, and we should be aware of them, and we should protect them.
Mm-hmm. I mean, from a filmmaker's point of view, what were the ethical implications of actually catching on camera someone who was maybe admitting to legal wrongdoing? You know, to you will be fired, or I mean, you know, what did you think? What was going through your mind when you saw that?
We struggled with that in the editing room because we didn't want to get anybody in trouble. On the other hand, it was so much a part of what was going on. We saw it left and right. It wasn't just in the few instances that we see in the film. We didn't want to overdo it. We have, I think there are two examples in the film. We could have had more. But again, we wanted to make a balanced picture because you also hear the management say, you know, why they don't want unions. And you hear some workers say why they don't want a union. And you hear some workers say why they do want a union.
Right.
But
it's sort of hard to there was one worker who talked about with the old company with when she was working for GM making, I think, close to $30 an hour. Mm-hmm. And now her wages were down to less than half.
Yeah, $12.84. That's Shawnee.
You want to talk about killing the American dream? I mean, you spoke so beautifully in the beginning about how those jobs, a person could have a good life, a real life.
Yeah, and they could have a sense of the future and hope and that their kids would do better. I mean, that's the kind of family I come from. I come from a working class family. The American dream does get discussed a bit toward the end of the film. You know, the American dream is supposed to be about you can, if you work hard, you don't have to have a college degree, you don't have to have an MBA or whatever, to have a solid life, a secure life for your family and yourself. That's the American dream. But how attainable is that now for workers in America? You know, as I said, whether you work for, you know, whether you work for a distribution center or a factory or you work in an office, it's, you know, some of the workers say, you know, we have to give up on the American dream. It's not going to happen. We'll never have that again. And others say, one guy at the end, Timmy, says, you can't give up on the American dream. That would be un-American.
Oh, my gosh. It's so profound.
Yeah.
So well said.
I know. I also feel, look, I'm from the Midwest, and I believe that the battle for the heart and soul of America for our next election, but mm-hmm. just in general, is taking place in the Midwest. It's taking place in the heartland of America.
Really?
Think about it. Ohio, Wisconsin, Michigan, Pennsylvania, that's the heartland. That's where who's ever going to win the hearts of America is going to win the election has got to pay attention to folks where I live, right? And we are hurting and we have not recovered from the economic downturn. And I think people, like our people in our film, feel like they're not understood, they're not represented in the mass media mm-hmm. very well. Mm-hmm. And that's one reason we made the film in our hometown, is to put those people on the screen to make them protagonists of their own story.
Well, it's a beautiful story and
thank
so
you.
Well told. I've been speaking with filmmaker Julia Reichert about her new Netflix doc, American Factory. Julia, thank you so much for spending some time with all of it.
Well, thank you. This has been fun and really engaging.
Thanks.
Mm-hmm.